Good morning. We doing okay today? Just stay dry. Holy cow. Tough day. Tough stuff. A lot of people to pray for this morning. A church that we are, a number of us are friends with and kind of came from to start Genesis. We got a call this morning, find out that church has a brand new building that has 4 inches of water in it. So, and we got in here really late this morning because the custodian that was supposed to open for us, we're like a run around like people who just lost their minds. I'm just letting you know, this is a crazy, crazy morning because normally we get in at 8 o'clock, we have a good 2 hours to set up and do everything. The custodian who was coming to let us in got stopped, and if I understood the story, got stopped by a tree that had fallen across Highway W, and as he stood there kind of trying to figure out what to do, the water kind of slid his truck into a ditch. And, you know, you see the fields out here and all that. Just tough days and tough times. So a lot to pray for this morning, a lot to be thankful for, but a lot to pray for. I just wanted to kind of, before I get into what I want to talk to you about, out of Ecclesiastes this morning, I wanted to highlight a couple things that go with our sense of purpose and mission that you can get involved with. The first thing is this. We as a church have a real passion about living our faith and making Eureka a better place. We believe that as people live the gospel, live the good news of Jesus in their lives, and they do that outside of themselves, meaning it's really easy sometimes to do church with a group of people and do Christianity with people who are all like you, but the call of Christianity is to live that faith even among people who may not even believe, and then to allow Christ to use us to build his kingdom, which means our existence in Eureka ought to make Eureka a better place because of the gospel and because of our being here. And so we're kind of asking you to consider getting involved with two different things that kind of reflect this as a passion of ours. The first is the fact that we have a partnership with Blevins Elementary. We see this as a way for us to do mercy and to live the gospel in that place where we're trying to help people who are just struggling and hurting and just need help. And God's given us Kevin Avenue at Blevins to do that. And one of the ways we do that is by sending people up to Blevins to hang out with kids who need help. And so we need, this is kind of a high level of commitment, but we need, you know, probably 6 or 8 people would be our goal who could say, you know, I could go up to Blevins for a half hour once a week and I would be willing to go in and tutor and help kids. Now, I did this all last year and I got to do it in Mrs. Krause's classroom, okay? And I'm really hoping that before anybody else draws my name, she gets me again. I really like being in her class. But for me, what I did is I went through and she often sent the kids who were struggling with their homework and struggling with just figuring things out, and I'd spend some time around the table, just walking them through some things and building relationships with those kids. We had other people who went up and they worked in a classroom where they literally were with the same kid every week, you know, and they worked with that one kid. But what we're doing is we're making ourselves available to the school, to teachers, and it just is a way for us to live the gospel, not preach it. I'm not saying we go in there and I sit down with the kids and I talk about Jesus. We don't. But to live the gospel, so that we're building, allowing God to use us to build the kingdom of God in Eureka and make Eureka a better place. That's a living out our faith. The second way is through this relationship that we're kind of building with the fire department. What they told us is that when people are, they have a catastrophe, fire, a flood, that Red Cross assistance kicks in. It takes about 48 to 72 hours. And that they are in crisis mode with nobody there to help them for that period of time until Red Cross can kind of step in and start assisting the family. And so what we said is, listen, let us be that group. And so we've given the fire department permission to call me at any time, day or night. They know my number. We're trying to build up just a tub full of supplies so that when there is a fire or a catastrophe, we can show up really quickly with some supplies, with a lot of stuff for the family, some teddy bears for the kids, just something they can hug as they're dealing with the loss of everything, toothbrushes, toothpaste. You can see the list. It's in your worship folder this morning. We'll show up with maybe a Walmart gift card so they can go buy their immediate needs, and that we can kind of be that step in and love on people and serve the broken and hurting for that 48 to 72 hour period until the other assistants can kind of come in and really start meeting the bigger needs of the family. And so you see the list in there, and what we're really asking is that you consider ways that you can be a part of either one of those. If you can, if you're interested in the deal with Blevins, we need to know really fast. I mean, we really actually need to go to the principal this week and set it up with at least the first people who are doing it. And so, catch me, catch Nick after the service, and talk to us about that one. With the other, you can just start bringing stuff, and we'll have tubs here. We'll start collecting it. Our leaders, Debbie Stein is leading it. Debbie's back here, and Debbie is when we kind of have, like, if we have 42 things of toothpaste but no soap, she'll kind of we'll put in the bulletin, hey, don't buy toothpaste, we need this, and we'll try to keep that informed. But this is a way for us to just make Eureka a better place, to live the mercy of God in this community, make a difference with the gospel by living it. And so it's our passion, it's who we are. We want Eureka to be a better place because we are a people living the gospel in this community. All right, so you can jump on, be a part of that. We appreciate it. Well, I went to San Francisco a couple years ago. We got a picture of Lombard Street up here. Went to San Francisco with my wife. I had all these things that I wanted to do. We had about half a day in San Francisco. I wanted to go eat seafood on Navy Pier. Not Navy Pier, what's... Fisherman's Wharf. Navy Pier, Chicago. I'm in the wrong city there. Fisherman's Wharf. I wanted to see the new ballpark. But my wife said, listen, I want to find Lombard Street. Now, do you guys know what Lombard Street is? It is this the crookedest road, the crookedest street in the world. It comes down through down this hill in San Francisco, and it's just kind of dead in the center of San Francisco. But what they did is they built it so that the road comes down from side to side. If you're in a 15-passenger van, you may not be able to make the turns. I mean, it is so crooked, and so, the turns are so sharp because it's just given cars ways to come down this really steep hill. And there are beautiful apartments on both sides of the street. It's filled with unbelievable flower arrangements, but it's this beautiful street. And so my wife said, I want to go see that. I saw it when I was a kid. I want to go see that again. And so we were driving around San Francisco, and in our minds, we saw it on a map. And so we hopped off this highway that kind of ran right down by the bay there and started trying to find this crooked street that's in the middle of San Francisco. And you kind of feel like you're always near it because you're always near a huge hill that's headed towards the water in San Francisco. So we thought, man, the map kind of looked like if we just go up this way, there's a little dot on the map, here's Lombard. If we just go this way, we'll end up... That little five-minute jaunt took us 2 hours as we drove around Lombard Street four times trying to find it. And all my time to go eat at Fisherman's Wharf and to go to the new ballpark, it was all gone. You know, we ran down, grabbed fast food, and had to leave because we spent all this time looking for this crooked street. And it was kind of a crazy exit. It was fun. I mean, it was cool to see the street and drive down it. But I missed all the stuff I wanted to see because we could not find a way to get to this crooked street. But this street is kind of going to be an illustration for what we're going to talk about as we continue our study of this incredible book of Ecclesiastes. If you haven't been with us, we kind of walk straight through books of the Bible. And we're kind of working through one of my favorite books, the book of Ecclesiastes, written by a guy named Solomon. He was the king in Israel. He kind of had incredible power, incredible wealth. He kind of had the life that as we kind of try to live the American dream, we set up as this is the life to live. If you have lots of money, lots of pleasure, lots of women, lots of stuff, if you can say something and everybody jumps to do it for you, that will make life work. It will make it fit. It will make it purposeful and meaningful. And we have all these pursuits in life. And what Solomon is telling us in this book is, listen, I have been all pro. I have been an all-American at every pursuit. Everything I put my mind to, I pulled it off and I accomplished. And I accomplished it in huge ways. You pursue wealth. Listen, I have wealth so that when the silver comes in, we just pile it up out next to the mulch piles because I don't have enough time to count my silver. I have too much gold. You pursue pleasure. You think, man, if you just had a couple girls or a boyfriend, whatever it is, listen, I got 1,000 women that are there at my every beck and call. You think it's through achievement, through building of buildings and leaving behind a legacy. Listen, I built the most significant buildings that at that time were maybe even on the planet. And what his conclusion is all those pursuits, worthless. There's something on the inside of me that is crying out that there has to be something else. And as I strive and pursue all these things, I just, nothing satisfies, nothing fills. And what's happened as we've studied the first six chapters of this book is that Solomon's kind of been laying out this as a philosophy, saying, listen, life is a vapor. It's a breath of wind. It's a puff of smoke. The word vapor, which is used more, I mean, it's used a lot. I forget the exact number, but it's well in the 50 or 60 times in this 12-chapter book. Kind of has two different meanings. One meaning is that it's short, it's brief. It's an exhale. You know, you're out in the winter air and you breathe out and you see it for a second, then it's gone. The word can also mean that it's meaningless, it's purposelessness, it has no value. And what he's trying to say to us is, listen, life under the sun, life on this planet, if that's all that there is, if all that we have is the here and now, it is impossible to find value and meaning and for life to connect, make sense, and work. I mean, no matter what it is, if we're pursuing something under the sun, and this is another phrase he uses a lot, under the sun, if we're pursuing life under the sun, meaning life in the here and now, life in this world, this natural, this place that we live, and if that is what we're pursuing to make sense of life and to find purpose and meaning, what's going to happen is I'm going to come to the same conclusion. I'm going to chase it. I'm going to get there and find that it was like chasing the wind, like a dog chasing his tail, that when he catches it, he's like, what did I get? Have you guys ever seen, this is totally random, so I'm sorry, but have you ever seen the America's Funniest Home Video of the dog sitting on the couch and it's like hind legs and it starts growling. It's got a bone in its mouth and it gets mad at its own hind leg and starts biting himself trying to protect his bone. That was just random. Anyway, but that's kind of like what life is like. We are protecting this, we're pursuing this, we're chasing our own tail, but if we catch it, if we get what we're pursuing, all of a sudden the testimony of this planet is it did not solve the disconnect in the soul. And what Solomon is really trying to encourage us and trying to challenge us with is that life should be an adventure of faith, that there is something else to live for that is outside the sun, that life is an adventure of faith in the pursuit of God. And last week we kind of said, listen, it's almost like going skydiving, that we have to take huge leaps of faith sometime to pursue God. And that on this pursuit, that we will find purpose and meaning, but it's not a formula, it's not a nice neat little cookie cutter. Everything will work. If you do A, B, and C, God will do D, E, and F, you know. But it's this pursuit, almost like a journey. And one of the things that we talk about a lot here is that the life of faith, the life of following Jesus, is both an event and a journey, meaning that there is a point where I start my walk with God. I start by giving my life to Jesus, and I've come to the event that is the launch of my faith. But it's also a journey, meaning it is a pursuit of something. It is a life on a highway. And that's kind of where we're kind of switching series here as we do Ecclesiastes, calling a little bit of this series Life is a Highway, meaning that we're on this journey and God is calling us to himself. He's given us his son, Jesus, to trust and to know and to pursue. And life is this pursuit. It is a journey towards knowing and experiencing God, which also means knowing and experiencing purpose and joy, value, hope, happiness in life. But what happens is I get on this journey and I'm cruising along and, you know, I've got a map out, I've got my destination, I know where I'm headed, and I get on this journey and I'm driving and I'm headed to where I want to go, but there are along the journey, there are all these highway signs and exit marks that are saying, listen, you want to stop here. You know, it's kind of like, going down to, as you go down to Georgia, you see all these signs for this one rock. And you see these signs, they start like way over in eastern Tennessee and Kentucky. get off and see this rock. And you get off, and finally you're like, all right, if there's this many billboards, it's got to be worth stopping and seeing. And you get off and see it, and it's a rock. You're like, seriously, who is spending all this money? But some guy on the inside is, you know, selling hats and t-shirts and making a bundle off of all these billboards. You get off and you see it, you're like, wow, this is a rock. I'm glad I wasted my time here. This is what life is like. We're on this journey. We're going down this highway. There's a call. And if you've started the life of faith, if you've trusted Christ, if you know Jesus, you're on this journey. And we're kind of cruising on this highway, this pursuit. And the Bible tells us it's not an easy road. It's not a wide road. It's not a road that's easy to follow. It's a narrow road. But we're on this narrow road. In fact, Jesus' words in Matthew chapter, I think it's chapter 7. He says this. You got that up there? Did you get that? Okay, Matthew, I must have given the wrong verse. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus says, chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, Jesus says, listen, wide is the road and wide is the gate that leads to destruction, but narrow, tight, hard is the road that leads to eternal life. And he says, very few find it. And what I'm saying is, and I think what Ecclesiastes, what Solomon's trying to get at with us is, listen, we are on this tight, narrow road, this pursuit of Jesus, but there are all kinds of exit signs, billboards, places where we can get off the track and we can end up getting lost. We can end up in this cul-de-sac where we just run around in circles and we get off base and we kind of lose our way in this life of faith. And Solomon wants to challenge us to know what those exits are, to know what those cul-de-sacs are, to know where those places are, to be able to spot those billboards and go, you know, that looks really cool. That looks really good. That looks like a great place to stop and exit. Man, there might be a Stuckey's there and I can get, you know, a honey and there's, you know, lots of the bees, or there might be a Cracker Barrel. But the truth of the matter is I need to stay on focus. I need to pursue God in this life of faith. And if I'm not careful, I will end up taking an exit and I will end up so far away from that life and I won't even know what happened. I'll end up at some rock, some tourist attraction on this journey. And Solomon wants to show us what these are, all right? So our series is going to be called Life is a Highway, because we're on this journey of faith, of knowing God. And if you're a follower of Jesus, that's the journey we're pursuing. But Solomon wants to remind us, listen, on this journey, be careful of those exit signs. They're everywhere. And if you're not careful, boom, you're off the highway. You are pursuing something different. You are in a place that is not where God intended for you to go. And we're going to use Lombard Street because this was my experience. I ended up on this really crooked street. I got off the exit, ended up on this really crooked street in San Francisco, which was really nice, but I didn't see anything that I wanted to see on that day to spend 3 minutes going down this street and getting a few pictures. And this is what, Solomon is eventually going to say, listen, this is a crooked deal. What is crooked can't be made straight. We're going to use that as kind of a launching point. And what's happening in this passage that we're going to look at is that Solomon is dealing with this. I mean, the entire book of Ecclesiastes is dealing with the fact that the human experience is twisted, it is broken, it is hard, it is hurtful. We can't get over ourselves, and we can't, I mean, the struggles of the world around us are so intense that we have a really hard time finding our way in life. Now, does that resolve with you? Do you feel the tension? I mean, I get a little bit nervous when I hear people standing on a stage in the name of Jesus saying, if you'll just do this, this, and this, everything will be perfect for you. This is a fallen, broken world. Solomon wants us to feel the tension of that. He wants us to struggle with that. But he also wants us to understand that there is a pursuit in life that in the midst of brokenness can bring joy, can take the meaninglessness and bring meaning to it. And so that's kind of the journey that Solomon is on. And what he's going to show us this morning is that there is an exit. There is a cul-de-sac that we all, man, we were pulled to really, really hard, and that is our own brokenness and sinfulness. And that sinfulness leads us to this incredible need for Christ to step into our lives and speak into our hurt and call us to himself. That's the journey, and the exit, man, there's all kinds of places I can get off, and all of a sudden I'm on this crooked road that really takes me nowhere. And so we're going to see in Solomon's words, and what he does is he begins to speak to us in Proverbs. Now, in the book of Ecclesiastes, this is actually, if people who outline the book, who write books on books of the Bible, will say that this is a change in focus. Chapters 1 through 6 are kind of why the world is so broken and why it's so hard and why there is so much struggle and why all the pursuits of this world just leave emptiness and meaningless. Chapter 7, he begins to say, but here's the way you live on this journey that kind of walks you through those things. Doesn't always solve them, but walks you through those things. And in chapter 7, he's starting to talk about that. So if you have your Bibles, you can flip over to Ecclesiastes 7. If you don't have Bibles, we have Bibles at the end of your rows. We'd love for you to take one of those Bibles, open it. We're going to be on page 472 in that Bible in chapter 7. And this morning, Solomon's just going to address us about our own brokenness, our own struggle, and the pull of that. And he's going to help us see, listen, we need to find ways to keep it between the ditches. We need to find ways to keep focused on him and keep the pursuit of God central in our lives, because there's all these cul-de-sacs pulling us away. I got a phone call this week. You just kind of deal with people who are hurting and people who see that the world is really, really hard. Phone call from and just a conversation with somebody who is living through the fact that the ideal family that this person had created or created in their mind and thought was going to work and is just crumbling. And there's abandonment. There's just all kinds of deep issues. You deal with the fact that there is something, that there's just something twisted and broken in us. And how is that fixed? How is that solved? Well, that is what Solomon is getting at this morning. He starts at chapter 7, verse 1, and he says, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. Well, you know, here you go with Solomon with the black fingernail polish, and, you know, he's back into his goth mode. You know, he's listening to Marilyn Manson music, and he's reading a lot of Nietzsche, and, you know, this is kind of the feel. If you've been with us for a while, you've heard me talk about this a lot, because Solomon has this real dark side, but the dark side is, he's not just dark. He's not just like depressed and, you know, wanting to go sit in a corner and get feathered, you know, hair and the earrings thing. And that's not what he's going for here. He's helping us realize that the darkness of this world ought to help us realize that life under the sun isn't all that exists. All right. Now, what happens here is he starts using a form of writing that he is very familiar with. He writes what are called Proverbs. There's a book of the Bible that is called the Book of Proverbs, and a large portion of it was written by the same person who wrote Ecclesiastes, Solomon, and Proverbs are these short, pithy, quick-hitting sayings that are designed to impart wisdom, to help us to see life through what does it mean to live wisely? Book of Proverbs, and even here it kind of comes out, wisdom is almost a person that is coming alongside of us and walking us through life. It is a perspective that looks at all these different real practical areas of life. In fact, the book of Proverbs may be the most practical book in the entire Bible, as it just kind of points us, hey, if I want to live and I want life to make sense and I don't want to, you know, if I don't want to just kind of wallow in my brokenness, here's how to do it. Here's the issues. And here's what a wise man and a fool looks like. And so what he uses here, they're called better than Proverbs. And for Solomon in this passage and a lot of the Proverbs, it's kind of a black and white world. Now, I don't think he means for it to say, well, here's black, here's white. There's no gray in between. But what he's doing is he takes two things and he compares them and he says, this is better than that. And the idea of better than, and you'll hear it. I mean, if you read, if you perk your ears up and watch, you'll see Solomon say in this passage alone, better than a number of times. Almost in every verse, he says, well, this is better than that. And what he's trying to show us is that there are ways to live and things to interact with that we need to be pursuing, and we need to allow Christ to work in our lives, because if we don't, the end is that we will end up living the life of a fool, someone who's disconnected from God and doesn't live for anything but themselves. And so he says, you know, he says here, a good name is better than precious ointment. Now, let me explain what this is. This is Solomon's way of saying you can put lipstick on a pig That phrase has hit our culture, hadn't it? But it's basically what he's saying. He's saying, listen, we spend our lives trying to make the outside look better and smell good. We go to the gym and we work out. We eat right. We get perfumes. I mean, incredible perfumes and deodorants that make us smell good most of the time. Some of you, not so much, but most of the time. We get lipstick. I don't, but you know, anyway, you get where I'm going with this. We get product for our hair. We make sure we get all these things and we really get the outside going. What Solomon's saying is, listen, a good name is better than perfume, is better than ointment, is better than hair gel, is better than lipstick. He's saying, listen, who you are in your character is more important than what you look like and smell like on the outside. Because if you're the type of person that when you walk in the room, you smell good, but everybody sitting at the table rolls their eyes when they think about who you are on the inside, that outside stuff doesn't matter. He's saying, listen, a good name. In the Bible, names are important. I mean, we're kind of playing with names right now. We're having twins. We have kicked out a lot of names. And what a lot of you don't know is that my youngest son, Josiah, has chosen names for our twin girls that are going to be born in January. He has chosen the names Jesse and Bessie. And if we sit around as a family and start saying, well, let's throw out some names, he gets mad. No. Their names are going to be Jesse and Bessie. And my wife goes, Bessie's a cow's name. And what you don't know is that he got these names from the movie Cars. You know, we played Life is a Highway. I mean, he got, Bessie is the road paver in that movie. But Jesse and Bessie, he is adamant about it. We pick names, and it's just kind of something that is important to us because our name does identify us. But in the Bible, names are so much deeper than just something that identifies us. Names are always about character. Bible names, especially, there are a number of times in the Bible where God changes the name of an individual after God has changed that person's life. So there's a guy, his name is Abram, which just means kind of this hierarchy of life kind of deal. And God calls him, and he's an old dude, he has an old wife, they have never had children. And God makes him a promise, says, listen, if you believe me, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. And Abraham, in his 90s, believes God, just says, all right, God, you said you would do this. I trust you. I don't know how you're going to pull this off. I mean, you know, my wife, I think she's well past the potential to do that. I thought that too, by the way. But she really was. I mean, at 90... If you're still having kids when you're in your 90s, God help you. And you know, but he said, God, I believe, and God changed his name to Abraham, which means father of many nations. Here's this guy walking around with no kids, and somebody says, hey, what's your name? Abraham. How many kids you got? None. Where'd you get that name? God gave it to me. Are you serious? What kind of, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid, dude. You've been smoking the weed. I don't know what's wrong with you. Father of many nations. But this is what God does. Often, in trying to help people interact with life, he changes their name in the scriptures, which is a sign of a transformation in character because they've met God. There's a lot of places in the Bible where this happens, but here's what he says. He says, a good name is better than perfume. And here's the issue. This is the issue of this entire list of Proverbs. There is something on the inside of us that keeps us from having a good name. There is a disconnect, a brokenness, a sinfulness that no matter how hard we try, how hard we strive, how hard we work at it, how we just can't get to the point where all these issues that are on the inside of me work. And so we strive to have a good name. We strive to get to the point where people think of us, if they're going to stand over our casket, they're going to say nice things. But the question is not just that, but how does God see our lives? Will he impart a different name into our lives that reflects a character that's been changed? And what he says here is he says, a good name is better than ointment. He also says the day of death is better than the day of your birth. Man, that's kind of morbid. But the issue here, what Solomon's going to try to get at, which he's going to unpack here in a minute, but I'm just kind of setting the stage here. I think what he's trying to get at is that when babies are born and you hold them, there is a potential there, and we ignore an inner reality that's part of the baby. I mean, we just see them as innocent and sweet and wonderful, and we're bouncing them, and there's this potential. We see all this good and all this hope and all this possibility, and then they turn two. And they're not so cute and cuddly anymore. And our mindset is, here they are, they're all beautiful, they're cute, they're wonderful. But the reality is that there is a disconnect even in those babies that is, I mean, at 3 months, their world is, life is about me, and I'm going to scream at the top of my lungs to make sure you remember that. And what Solomon's getting at, it's not that it's birth is bad. This isn't one of those, you know, I wish you were never born kind of things. What he's trying to say is, listen, life actualized is where it really counts. That I should not live for my birth looking back to what I could have been, but I am on this journey to this point where all my decisions, all my choices, my whole life is going to be actualized, and the choices I make and what I pursue with my life is going to be determined, and the rest of eternity is going to be the result of what I did in this life. It is better for me to live for that day than for that day. You see what I'm saying here? You get it? I am on this journey, and now there are these things that are calling me off the highway, and if I get off track, if I miss it. And so I need to be living for life and for death, for that time, because Solomon helps us see, listen, the pursuit of what happens there is what really matters. There was a point in time where every one of you in here, somebody held you, bounced you on their lap and looked at you and said you were cute. Even if you weren't, they said it because it would hurt your mama if you weren't. You ever have that where you're holding a baby and you're just like, really? But you can't say it because the mom's there. Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. And so if our babies are ugly, don't say anything. They won't be. We have beautiful babies. At least I think so. Anyway, so here's the issue. This sinfulness, and what Solomon wants us to do is Solomon wants us to struggle with this, and he wants to see, and there's kind of three areas that we're going to point out here in this text, in this passage, that Solomon wants us to get God's perspective. And the issue here is wisdom. Wisdom in the Bible, like I said, it's in the Proverbs, it's kind of personified. Wisdom in the Bible is this pursuit of life where I begin to see life from God's perspective and I apply it. It is when I start to stop seeing things under the sun, as Solomon has said it, but I begin to get a perspective that is from God, from the divine, from his purpose in my life. And what Solomon's going to do, you're going to see the word wisdom, you're going to see the word better than, you're going to see all this in these Proverbs, in these short little pithy sayings, but the tying bind is that there is a brokenness in us that is a deep problem. I need to get God's perspective about this brokenness. I need to get God's perspective about my struggle. I need to get God's perspective about the highway that I'm on and the exits that I really like to take because the billboards really look good. I need to get God's perspective for that so that I can maneuver through it. All right, and the first thing he wants to help us with is he wants to help us get God's perspective about sin. Look at verses 2-4 here. He says, "It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all of mankind. Sorrow is better than laughter, for the sadness of face, the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools are in the house of mirth." Now, once again, you see how it just seems like, man, it's better to be in a funeral parlor than it is to be in a bar. You know, once again, you feel the tension of, man, is he really this dark? But what Solomon's saying is, listen, as a matter of life, when I'm in times of mourning, when I'm in times of hardship, when I'm in times that make me angry, it is in those times that I really deal with the depth of who I am and my need. And in the Bible, Jesus, in fact, in Matthew chapter 5, is teaching. He said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." And what he's referring to, we mourn after death. I mean, when you lose a loved one, we have a family today that is dealing with the struggle of losing somebody that was close to them. And when you deal with death, there is a grieving, there is a brokenness, there's a depth of heart that we look at this and go, you know, this is not the way it should be. I don't like feeling like this, and I just don't like this brokenness. But what you have to understand is you read the Bible, there is this marriage, this connectedness, this binding of two big issues. And that is the issue of sinfulness and the issue of death. The very first two people, God is speaking to them, Adam and Eve, they're in the garden, they have this perfect relationship, and God has breathed his life into them. And he puts a tree in the middle of a garden. He says, listen, you can enjoy everything in life. You can eat from any tree. You can have fun. You enjoy the animals. I made this world for you. Enjoy it. But there's a tree. Don't eat from that tree. If you eat from that tree, you will die. Now, Adam and Eve are in a garden. What he had given them was unbelievable. But in the middle of the garden, there was a decision. They had to walk by that tree. Every time they walked by it, they had to make a decision. Will I live for myself? Will I live for my own purpose and glory, or will I live to honor the God and live for the God who made me and loves me deeply? And at one point in time, they said, you know what? We don't want a God. We want to be our own God. We want to do what we want. We don't want God telling us what to do. And they made a decision of the heart to eat the fruit that God has said don't do. And the result of that is death. Now, in the story, you read the story, and one of the struggles you'll have as you read the story is God said, if you eat it, you'll die. You kind of expect, you know, a bite of the apple pie and they keel over and it doesn't happen. They live for a long time after that. But in a different, in a very real sense, the moment that they consumed the fruit, the moment they made a decision that I don't want God, there was a death in their lives, a disconnect between them and God. And their source of life was their creator. There is a death there. That showed up, and it worked itself out physically many, many years later. And in the same way, you and I live in a world, and the Bible says over and over again that the soul that sins, it will die, that the wages of sin is death. Death and sin are always in the Bible tied very closely. And when we go to a funeral, it's not that I'm saying that the person is there because of they did some heinous sin and God was getting them. I'm saying death is not the way God created us. And when we walk up to a casket, we walk into a funeral, there is brokenness and mourning, but we ought to see past just death to realize that it is the twistedness of the human experience that has caused this. This is the result of our sinfulness and our brokenness, our disconnect from God. And Solomon says, listen, it's better to mourn than to go into the house of mourning, meaning it's better to see life from the perspective of a funeral parlor than to see life from the perspective of the house of feasting, which is probably a pub or a bar. It's better to see life from the perspective of sorrow, verse 3. And actually the word sorrow has the idea of anger in it. The twistedness and brokenness in this world ought to leave us with a sense of anger over sinfulness, over. You know, I hear stories, and another phone call of somebody just kind of random. I found out this week that somebody I actually respected a lot has left his wife. And there's something on the inside of me that just makes me angry. We ought to feel that way. But then do I stop and look at my own willful choices to live for myself rather than the one who created me and have the same kind of brokenness and anger over that? And what Solomon's saying, listen, we need to approach life and realize these things are real. And one approach to it is to just kind of sweep it under the rug and eat, drink, and be happy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Just act like it's not there. I'm a good person. Life's okay. And just to kind of sing songs and do dances and go to bars and just hang out and live life and not focus on it. And Solomon's saying, listen, the better way is to be realistic about our brokenness and to come to the point where we honestly mourn over our own sinfulness. It is really hard. I mean, like, you know, some of you have been hanging out and, you know, you come to a church and you know what? You read a lot. Don't preach about sin. Don't stand up and talk to people about their sinfulness, their disconnect with God, their brokenness. Because people won't want to come to a church where you talk about sin. But the problem is that if we don't talk about our disconnect and the fact that it is our own choices that lead to this on a very real level, I'll never come to the point where I can really explain the gospel to you that God is the solution to this. Trust him. If we just talk about, well, you can have your best life now and you can feel good about yourself and you have all this wonderful potential in you, and I don't show you that there is something wrong inside of you that causes you, as C.S. Lewis puts it in the book Mere Christianity, he says, we have these two things that are going on all the time. There is something on the inside of us that tells us there is a standard in this world. And so our conscience says, man, there are things that are right, there are things that are wrong. But at the same time, we know on the inside of our heart there is a standard. We have this freakish desire to break the very rules we know that are there. I'm like that. I'm like, hey, a rule. It's there is only a suggestion to try to mess with. I got teased this week. We went to this conference with some people, and they stood up in front and said, no food or drink in the theater. I did not obey that rule. I hid the bottled water in my wife's purse, and her excuse was, I'm pregnant, I need it. And I said, well, I'm with a pregnant woman, I need one too. Merely suggestions for us to, we have this desire on the inside of us to do, and there's this disconnect, this brokenness. And if you don't recognize that in yourself, it's going to be hard for you to see your need for God. We need to get God's perspective about our sinfulness. So what is it? When we talk about sin, I mean, you know, when we have these messages and you know, our goal is to get up here and make you feel as bad about yourself as possible, that's not actually the goal. The goal is to help you see, listen, my sin causes this disconnect. It causes this death, this twistedness in my life. I just need to be honest about it. When the Bible talks about this, sin kind of shows up as meeting three kind of ideas. One is the fact that we have a holy God that is creator. He is perfect, and he does have a standard. And that's important. But sin is also idolatry, meaning I have this sense of I value anything in this world more than God. And that I exalt everything in life, money, sex, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a car, a house, my kids. I value everything over the value of knowing Jesus and knowing God in my life. And sin is also pictured for us as this thing that brings a disconnect in relationship. It can be a disconnect in relationship with my wife, with friends, with people, where I do things that hurt them and are wrong. And in a very real way, the same thing is true of my relationship with God. And what Solomon wants us to do is he says, listen, we need to have a real sense of being real about these issues. Sweeping under the rug and not being honest about our life is not going to solve this. There needs to be a sense that I experience brokenness in life, but I also have a brokenness over the fact that every day I choose to be in total control of my life. And every time I see one of these glitzy, shiny billboards, I flip my blinker on as fast as I can and I find that crooked street. And Solomon says, something ought to go off on the inside of us that says, I need more. I want something else. And it ought to leave us hurting, broken, angry, frustrated. And when you start feeling that way about yourself and your experience, this is the first step in experiencing grace. And so he goes on, he says, not only God's perspective about sin, he also says God's perspective about self. Look at this, verses 5 through 12. First, he starts by saying this, it is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than the song of fools. For as a crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This is also vanity. This is what God says. We need to kind of see ourselves clearly and our weaknesses. And God sends people in our lives sometimes that point those things out. How do you deal with criticism? How do you deal with somebody who walks up to you and says, hey, listen, I see this in your life. I think you're struggling. I think you're doing this or doing that. I think you have this struggle. You hurt me. You. I don't know about you, but I go on attack mode right away. Now, there's different ways. You may be a person who's kind of a submarine. You dive, or you may avoid. If you come after me, and you tell me how I'm wrong, my tendency is I am going to choke you. I will take you out. I will pop you with my forearm. I will put a hockey move on you. We are going to drop the gloves and go. And I am good at this, okay? I can show you your faults really fast, and I am a pretty persuasive arguer. Now you may do it in different ways, but all of us have a tendency that when somebody comes and points out the fact that I have struggles, we have our way of avoiding or disconnecting or whatever it is, and we really like those people who sing songs about it. This is what he says. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise person than to sing a song of fools. We like to pop in our CD that makes us feel like everything I'm doing is okay, and we like the songs. We like to, you know, cruise with the tunes or go listen to the band that affirms who I am, that affirms me. And this is what he says. He says, it's like thorns crackling under a pot. Here's what's going on. You take thorns and thistles and put them under a pot, and you're like, I'm going to cook this, but you use thorns and thistles. You will light those thorns and thistles. They will crack and burn really fast, but they won't heat the pot at all. And he says, if all you do is hang around with people who tell you how wonderful and beautiful and happy your life is, we'll never look you in the eye and say, listen, I see this in your life, and you might want to deal with this. If all you do is gather around people who will high-five you and sing music and make you feel like life is just beautiful, it's like thorns who make all kinds of noise and there's all kinds of popping, but the pot never cooks, it never heats up. And he says, listen, there are issues in our lives. We need somebody to come along. One of my questions for you today is, as you struggle through life, do you have somebody that you've given permission to speak into your life? To look at you and say, listen, I see this in you. Pray about this. Let me pray with you. Let me walk through this with you. Have you given anybody permission to do that? Because we need people to help us have an honest perspective about ourselves. And then what Solomon does in this passage, he begins to list some issues. And personally, I think these are some of the issues that he struggles with. This is not a comprehensive list. This is kind of a few of the issues he struggles with. Look at him. He says, verse 7. He says, surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. First thing is bribery and corruption. He says, listen, one area that people, and maybe he's saying one area I struggle, is if somebody comes alongside, there's a billboard that says you can make a quick buck, I take that exit really fast, and I end up on a crooked street. I am on that exit before I can tell you where to go. I've got my camel going that way because I didn't have cars then. And I will take this exit because if there is a bribe, if there is corruption, all that kind of stuff, it grabs my heart because I'm always looking for a way to turn around a few extra bucks. Verse 8, better is the end of the thing than the beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Second thing he kind of points out here is he kind of examines his own self. He says, listen, I have this deal where I dream big, but nothing ever happens. And I get real proud about my accomplishment, what I can do, what I can pull off, what I can make happen. He says, it's really better if I'm patient and quiet and not proud. And it's better if I actually get something accomplished than I just have everything on paper as big dreams. And my spiritual life is like this a lot. I'll sit around, I'll read the Bible. I'll go, okay, God, I read your scriptures. And I'm going to do all this stuff. I'm going to make it happen. And I just never get there. I have this pride about my ability to pull things off, but I just never see it work in life. He goes on to say, verse 9, be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. He says another area that, listen, another cul-de-sac, another axe that I tend to jump off of is anger. He says, here's the deal. I have this quick temper. And man, somebody just provokes me. Somebody does anything. I am quick to be angry. And anger just lodges in my chest. You know, you find that there's all kinds of heart issues, all kinds of health issues that come from anger. This verse describes me to a T. I am really quick to jump to conclusions and to be angry with people, sometimes without even having all the facts. And he says, listen, this is an exit. This is a call. It's crooked. It's not straight. Verse 10, say not, why were the former days better than these? It is not from wisdom that you ask this. He says, another place people will tend to get off track and kind of hit the cul-de-sac is when we're saying, hey, man, the glory days. It used to be like this. Why can't life go back to being a certain way? Why can't I, why can't I experience life, you know, when it was, I was young and I was the star on the football team, and my girlfriend was really, you know, she was cute and flirtatious. Why can't my guy be a certain way? And you know, I used to get treated this way, and I always live in the past, and I have this deep-seated lust for something that just doesn't fit with the way life works. There's a lust there. You see what he's doing here? He's giving us a list of these things that for him are these billboards. For us, it may be these things, it may be others. In verse 11 and 12, he talks about the issues of money. Wisdom's a good thing with an inheritance and an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom perseveres in the life of him who has it. In other words, if you have money, that's great, but if you have money without wisdom, it's not going to be much of a protection. And Solomon's kind of like, you know, if I see a billboard with lights and money, and I'm off, and it's a crooked road. If you have money with wisdom, it's not wrong to have money, but if you have money with wisdom, you can use that for the glory of God and his purposes. But if not, and what Solomon's pictured for us here is just a few areas that end up being like Lombard Street in our lives. They are crooked. They are bent. They will lead us in the wrong direction and get us off the road that is the pursuit of God and his joy and meaning in life. And so he ends like this, and this is where this whole passage, I need to be honest about my sin. I need to be honest about myself. I need to look at my own weaknesses. I need to realize that there are areas in life, and we're different in this. None of these may have spoken to you, but here's the deal. All of us have areas of life that if we see that billboard, we will take the exit. If we recognize that issue, it may, you know, for me, like I said, anger. For you, it may be issues of lust. It may be alcohol. And we need to be honest in our lives about the things that we are weak, the places where we struggle, we are broken, we tend to be drawn to. We need to be careful that if we have those areas in life that we're not like, you know, hanging out there. But we also need to realize that even if we don't hang out in places where it's easy for that to happen, that's very easy for me to get sucked into that. I mean, I kind of mentioned the anger thing. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but I do know that for me, that ends up being a place where if I'm not careful, and I will be, you know, mad at a waitress or mad at somebody behind, you know, with you know, a McDonald's hat on because I didn't get the right cheeseburger really fast. And I don't like plan for those settings. They just happen. And I've caught myself in the middle of being angry at somebody and going, what the heck am I doing? This is somebody who's working for, you know, almost minimum wage. Why am I mad at this person? I ought to be blessing them in some way. Recognize the struggle. And then sometimes it's because somebody's like, dude, why did you yell at that person? I want to choke them now. I'm mad at them. And Solomon is saying, listen, we need to find the places we're weak. We need to be honest about ourselves. But, and here's the conclusion. This is the most important part. Verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God, who can make straight that which he has made crooked. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. He says, listen, this is kind of where our lives are. We are crooked. We are broken. We struggle. Our lives are full of sin. They're full of our own choices. We need to be honest. We need to get God's perspective about that. We need to get God's perspective about our weakness. But we also need to realize that I cannot fix this. I cannot go to church enough. I cannot be good enough. I cannot go through enough of the rituals in religion. I cannot make enough promises. I cannot work hard enough. I cannot read the Bible long enough to fix this myself. God has made this life crooked. It is a result of the fall, as a result of our sinfulness, but God has woven this into the world so that we should be looking to him. And the brokenness in this world, the only one who can make it straight is God himself. As long as I am trying to come up with solutions to my problem here, what Solomon is saying is, listen, I cannot straighten what's crooked. I mean, think about this in your own life. You know, every one of us has something in our life that is a struggle with something we just could not get rid of. It might have been smoking or drinking or tobacco, you know, chewing skull. That was my deal for a long time, was dipping, you know, skull. I could not overcome it. It might be lust. It might be, you know, that you have these images of girls or men in your mind and you just can't get rid of them. And you make promises. You do self-discipline. You work your tail off. How's it working? And sometimes we give up one problem just to embrace another. We quit, you know, a tobacco issue and we take up Krispy Kreme donuts to take its place. there is a twistedness, a brokenness in our experience. Solomon wants us to be honest about this and see it from God's perspective. And he says, listen, we can't fix it. But the good news of the gospel, the story of the Bible, is that Christ came to deal with that. He gave his life to fix our twistedness and brokenness and give us a narrow road to pursue God. And so as we talk about this, God's perspective on the solution to this issue is not our own self-reform. It's not do a better job with your sin. It's admit that I'm broken, I need to be fixed, and to come to Christ who will fix you, who will bring forgiveness and beauty and hope and joy in life, even in the midst of our brokenness. And it doesn't mean that I get to the point where even that is perfect. I'm broken. I mean, it's an everyday walk of saying, God, I need to mourn over my sin. I need to be honest that I have areas of weakness. Now I need to come to you and go, I can't fix this. I am totally screwed if you don't do something in my life. If you don't step in and fix me, I'm hopeless because I cannot solve this myself. And the promise of the gospel is that through Christ, God does. He forgives and brings beauty and hope and mercy in our lives. And that's the good news of Solomon's story. It's the good news of my story. And it should, hopefully, it's the good news of your story. And this is the way Solomon concludes this section. It's a very interesting verse. He says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. In other words, when you have a good day, that ought to point us to rejoice and give thanks to God. And when you have a bad day, that ought to help us realize that God even put those in our path to cause us to look up. So tomorrow morning, you wake up and your kids are happy. They love the Fruit Loops you put in front of them. The cup of coffee you make is perfect. You even put a little whipped cream on it because it's wonderful. You get to work, and man, everybody there just has a smile on their face. The Cardinals miraculously somehow won a game, and the Rams didn't lose by 40 today. It's a good day. It ought to cause us to look up and give thanks because we have a God who loves us, who's merciful. And if you wake up tomorrow and the Rams get their butts kicked and life is horrible and you kick the counter on the way out and you have a bruise and your kids are screaming and even your own sinfulness, you walk in, you know, up somebody and they say the wrong thing and you bite their head off and you get angry and all of a sudden you're like, I am just so messed up and you have a bad day tomorrow, it ought to cause us to look up and see the grace and mercy of God and run to him. And either way, this verse is key in this entire thing. Either way, I am on this pursuit. There are billboards calling us to live in my own sinfulness and grovel in it and ignore it. And Christ is calling me to say, if it's a good day, give praise. Because that good day is a gift from God. And if you make it through a day and you're quitting a habit and you make it through the day and it's a good day, it's his grace and mercy in your life. And if you go out tomorrow and you really screw it all up and it's horrible, look up because the only answer to the issue is Jesus. Trust him. Either way, I'm running after Jesus. I'm staying on the road, the narrow road pursuing Christ. That's grace. That's the gospel. That's how Solomon wants us to deal with the exits that are our own sinfulness and brokenness. Honest about sin. I need to mourn. I need to be broken. Honest about myself. I have horrible weaknesses and I will fall to them all the time, but honest about the solution, Jesus is the answer. And that is what the message of grace is all about. So today, that's what I'm calling you to. If you're a follower of Jesus, what does that mean for you? Where does repentance and joy and pursuit of Christ? And if you're not, if you're like just checking Christianity out, what does it mean to trust Christ with your brokenness and twistedness? You will not fix yourself here. Can't do it. I'm going to pray. Bands will come out. We're going to sing. We're going to worship. We're going to praise and honor Christ because of his goodness. We're going to take up an offering, which if you're a guest, this is not for you. We take up an offering as an act of worship for people who are part of Genesis as a way to say, listen, God has done so much. We're just giving back a little bit back to him as a way to say thank you. And so our offering is for that. But if you're a guest, we don't ask you to give. Don't expect you to give. But we're going to stand and we're going to sing and we're going to worship Jesus, who is the solution. God, we love you, praise you, and give thanks today. And I just pray that as we kind of look at this passage about our own twistedness and the broken experience that we have as humans, you will help us to see that you are the solution to this and help us look to you. And because you died and took our place, we can have hope, and I give thanks for that. In your name I pray.